Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome to The Deep Dive. We're the hosts who take fascinating sources and, well, try to turn them into essential knowledge for you. Today, we are definitely leaving Earth behind. We're embarking on an unforgettable journey. We're doing a deep dive into Terence Dickinson's truly spectacular book, The Solar System, a grand tour of cosmic worlds. It's just stunning.
Oh, it really is. And it's a fantastic source for us to explore. Mm-hmm. Dickinson's work, you know, it's such a powerful reminder that our solar system is, well, it's way more than just a bunch of scattered rocks and gas balls. Mm-hmm. It's this interconnected dynamic system, yeah. A kind of living laboratory that's been evolving for, 4.6 billion years.
Right.
And for you, the listener, getting a handle on our local cosmic family, it really gives you the blueprint for understanding how galaxies are structured. Mm. And maybe more importantly, it tells this profound story about life's potential, and its incredible fragility.
Absolutely. Now, Dickinson himself, he lived from 1943 to 2023, a giant in popular astronomy writing, especially in North America. But what's interesting, and maybe you can speak to this, is that he wasn't, you know, a traditional research astronomer with a PhD.
That's exactly right. And it's kind of the key to his appeal. His authority didn't come from academic papers. It came from decades of actual hands-on experience. Just looking up, he was a master observer. He spent his whole life looking through telescopes, figuring out complex data, and then sharing it with this infectious enthusiasm. He founded Sky News magazine, too.
Oh, right.
And his unique gift was bridging that gap, you know, between the really dense astrophysics, all the jargon, the equations, and creating these accessible visual stories. He was like the ultimate tour guide to the cosmos, making things that are incredibly distant feel, well, almost immediate.
And the book reflects that perfectly. It's just this masterpiece of visual communication. You've got his clear, lucid writing side by side with these extraordinary high-resolution images, many from NASA, the European Space Agency, just groundbreaking stuff. The goal isn't just to tell you about these places. It's really trying to transport you, to make you feel what it might be like to stand on Mars or near Saturn's rings.
Definitely. And to do that, he structures the tour very logically.
Yeah.
Starts at the center, works his way out. Mm. First, the foundation, how the solar system formed the nebular hypothesis. Mm. And, of course, the sun, the anchor, holding it all together, containing like 99.8% of all the mass in the system.
Wow, 99.8% just puts everything else in perspective.
It really does. Then he moves to the inner worlds. These are the rocky, dense planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, our little neighborhood.
And then you cross the asteroid belt, and it's like everything changes, right? The whole character of the system shifts.
Completely. You hit the outer worlds. First, the gas giants, Jupiter and Saturn. Mostly hydrogen and helium, just enormous. Then beyond them, the ice giants, Uranus and Neptune. Chemically different, these ones. Made of heavier stuff. Water, methane, ammonia ices. And finally, the tour pushes out into that really cold frontier. The Kuiper Belt, past Pluto, and eventually towards the Oort cloud, where the comets are thought to come from.
And threading through it all, you really get the sense of celebration for our robotic explorers, don't you? The Voyagers, Cassini, the Mars rovers, they're like the unsung heroes of the book. Their discoveries really make this feel like the definitive family album of the solar system. It's their pictures, their data. Okay, so let's take that roadmap Dickinson laid out and actually start the journey, beginning right in the thick of it, the inner system. Mercury, for instance. We often just think scorched rock. But the messenger mission found something, well, pretty surprising, didn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Mercury is all about paradox. Yes, the side facing the sun gets incredibly hot, over 800 degrees Fahrenheit. But messenger confirmed there are large amounts of water ice tucked away inside craters near the poles.
Water ice on Mercury. How?
Because Mercury barely tilts on its axis. No. So the bottoms of these deep polar craters are in permanent shadow. They never see sunlight. Ever. They act like cosmic refrigerators, these cold traps, preserving ice that might be billions of years old. It just completely flips the script on a supposedly dead planet.
Wow. Okay. And speaking of extremes, then there's Venus. Dickinson paints it as this real, like, cautionary tale, right? It's not just facts. It's almost a planetary horror story.
He really does. Venus is the textbook example of a runaway greenhouse effect gone totally wild. Its atmosphere is basically all carbon dioxide, super thick, crushing pressure. It traps heat like crazy, so surface temperature, hot enough to melt lead. It's this stark, visceral warning about how planetary climates can collapse. The line between a thriving world like Earth and, well, that, it can be frighteningly thin.
It really makes you think. Okay, so moving outwards past Mars and the asteroid belt, the story shifts dramatically. Jupiter. Dickinson really stresses it's not just one planet. It's like a mini solar system in itself. What's the most sort of mind-blowing thing about its big moons, the Galilean ones?
I think it's the sheer diversity of those moons and how Jupiter itself kind of powers them in weird ways. Take Io. It's the most volcanically active place in the entire solar system. But that heat isn't coming from inside, like Earth's volcanoes.
No, where then?
It's tidal heating. Io is constantly being stretched and squeezed by Jupiter's immense gravity and also by the gravitational tugs from the other big moons nearby Europa, Ganymede, Callisto. This constant pushing and pulling creates massive friction inside Io, heating it up and fueling those endless volcanic eruptions.
That's incredible. Just being pulled apart generates that much heat. And that idea, gravitational heating, that leads us straight to Europa, doesn't it? Which everyone's so excited about.
Yes, exactly. What's so fascinating with Europa is the strong evidence for a huge, salty, liquid water ocean hidden beneath its icy shell. That same gravitational stretching from Jupiter provides enough warmth deep down to keep the water liquid. And that changes everything. It challenges that old idea that life needs a planet in the Goldilocks zone close to the sun. If Europa has liquid water, chemical building blocks, and an energy source that tidal heat well, it becomes a prime candidate for finding microbial life way out there in the cold.
Okay, shifting focus to Saturn, the Cassini mission, with the Huygens probe that landed on Titan, that just opened up a whole new world, or worlds, didn't it? Tell us about Titan. It sounds utterly alien.
Titan is. Yeah, it's like an alien chemistry lab. It's the only moon we know of with a thick, dense atmosphere. So thick you could almost strap on wings and fly, theoretically. Well, maybe not quite, but it's dense. And it has a weather cycle like Earth, clouds, rain, rivers, lakes, seas. But here's the twist. The liquid isn't water. It's liquid methane and ethane, flowing rivers of natural gas, basically at incredibly cold temperatures. It just shows that complex geology, complex weather,
yeah,
it can happen with totally different chemistry than ours.
Wow, rivers of methane. Okay. And we can't skip Saturn's little moon, Enceladus, right? That was another big surprise.
It's a huge surprise. Enceladus is tiny, bright white, covered in ice. But Cassini flew through these giant plumes, these geysers erupting from cracks near its south pole. They call them tiger stripes.
Oh, geysers on a tiny moon.
Exactly. Spewing water vapor and ice crystals straight out into space. This was basically proof positive that Enceladus also has a subsurface ocean of liquid water, and it's actively venting into space. So again, the theme is clear. The outer solar system is way more geologically active and potentially watery than we ever dreamed.
So let's push out even further to wrap up the tour into the icy frontier. Mars is still kind of the central puzzle, isn't it? We see all this evidence. It used to be warmer, wetter, dry riverbeds, deltas. What's the thinking on what actually happened to it?
The key seems to be the loss of its global magnetic field. Dickinson really highlights this. Billions of years ago, Mars' core cooled down and the internal dynamo that generated the magnetic field shut off.
And why was that so catastrophic?
Because that magnetic field acted like a shield. Without it, the solar wind, this constant stream of charged particles blasting out from the sun, could just strip away Mars' atmosphere over millions and millions of years. So the air got thinner, the planet got colder, the water froze or evaporated. Those ancient riverbeds the rovers are exploring, they're relics of that warmer, wetter past. It makes the search for signs of past or maybe even present microbial life even more compelling.
Right. And then this is where it gets really interesting for me. The outer edge, Pluto. We used to think of it as just this tiny, frozen, dead rock at the edge of everything. Then New Horizons flew by.
And just blew everyone's minds. Yeah. It was a total revelation. New Horizons showed Pluto is incredibly complex, geologically active, even today, billions of miles from the sun. It has vast plains of nitrogen ice that seem to be flowing like glaciers on Earth. It has towering mountains made of water ice.
Active geology so far from the sun. How?
That's the big question. Maybe some internal heat left over. Maybe tidal forces from its large moon, Charon. Maybe radioactive decay. But whatever the cause, it completely shattered the old idea that things out there would just be frozen solid and unchanging. The Kuiper Belt isn't just empty space. It's full of these complex, fascinating little worlds.
And we have to quickly touch on Triton, Neptune's big moon, because it's another really weird one.
Absolutely. Triton is fascinating. First off, it orbits Neptune backwards, a retrograde orbit. That strongly suggests it wasn't formed with Neptune, but was actually a dwarf planet, maybe like Pluto, captured from the Kuiper Belt billions of years ago.
Captured, wow.
Yeah. And even weirder, Voyager 2 spotted active geysers on Triton 2. Not water, but nitrogen frost erupting into its super thin atmosphere. So again, it just reinforces this point Dickinson makes. The outer solar system is surprisingly dynamic. There's geology happening out there, driven by forces we're still trying to fully understand. You know, one thing Dickinson does repeatedly, and it's so effective, is trying to get us to wrap our heads around the scale of it all. The distances are just mind-boggling.
Yeah, the numbers are almost meaningless, aren't they?
Exactly. So he uses analogies. Like, imagine the sun is the size of a grapefruit. Okay. Then Earth, on that scale, would be just a tiny pinhead, meters and meters away.
Right. Like, across the room or even further.
Further. Many meters.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking about it physically like that, rather than just hearing 93 million miles,
yeah,
it forces this radical shift in perspective. It makes you realize you have to, as he puts it, sort of abandon all terrestrial notions of distance and time to even begin to comprehend the solar system.
And that connects to another big theme, doesn't it? Comparative planetology, using the other planets to understand Earth.
Precisely. By showing us the hellish furnace of Venus, the frozen, irradiated desert of Mars, Dickinson builds this powerful case for Earth's, well, its astonishing preciousness, as he calls it, and its fragility. These other worlds act as foils, highlighting just how incredibly special and finely balanced the conditions are here that allow for liquid water and ultimately life. It really drives home environmental awareness without being preachy.
It makes you look at our own planet differently.
It absolutely should. And the final big theme woven through is really the triumph of robotic exploration. Dickinson makes it clear that our knowledge isn't static. It's constantly being updated, expanded, revolutionized by these incredible machines we send out there, Voyager, Cassini, New Horizons, the Mars rovers. There are chapters in this ongoing human story of discovery. It underscores the value of curiosity, ingenuity, and frankly, investing in science.
Yeah, the book is just packed with these moments, these lines that really stick with you and kind of change how you look up at the night sky.
He definitely has a way with words that gets at the deeper meaning. There are a few core ideas that really stand out. One is that point about scale. We had to abandon all terrestrial notions of distance and time.
Yeah.
It forces you out of your everyday mindset.
Right, that cosmic viewpoint.
Then there's the perspective on Earth. He says something like, in the grand cosmic gallery, Earth is the lone masterpiece of life. But then he adds that studying the sterile beauty of other worlds teaches us not about their inferiority, but about the astonishing preciousness and fragility of our own. It's a beautiful call for humility and taking care of what we have.
That's powerful.
And finally, he really celebrates the human spirit behind it all. Something like, we send robots to these worlds, but it is humanity's collective curiosity that makes the journey. It reminds us that exploration isn't just about machines and data. It's a deeply human drive.
So, okay, bringing it back down to Earth, maybe. How does knowing all this stuff about other planets actually, how does it apply to us? What's the takeaway for our daily lives?
I think the biggest application is fostering what you might call a cosmic perspective, really internalizing the sheer vastness of space, the age of the universe, the violence of planetary formation, the hostility of most places. It can be incredibly humbling. It can make our own everyday worries, even our big societal conflicts, seem, well, smaller. Seen against that cosmic backdrop, it underscores our shared humanity on this one tiny, fragile planet. It promotes a sense of unity, maybe.
That makes sense. Seeing the bigger picture can shrink the immediate problems. And what about the environmental angle? You mentioned Venus.
Yes, that's probably the most direct and urgent application. Dickinson's description of Venus's runaway greenhouse effect isn't just abstract science. It's a visceral, real-world example of a climate tipping point. It shows how planetary atmospheres work, how delicate the balance can be, and what the consequences are when that balance is lost. It makes the climate change discussion here on Earth feel much more concrete and, frankly, more urgent.
It's like seeing a potential future we desperately need to avoid.
Exactly. It's a warning written across an entire planet. So for me, the final big takeaway is seeing the solar system as this integrated dynamic system. Everything affects everything else. Jupiter's gravity shapes Io's volcanoes. No. Neptune capturing Triton creates this weird moon. Understanding these complex interactions, this system's thinking, is incredibly valuable. It applies not just to planets, but to ecosystems, economies, societies, any complex network.
That's a great point, that interconnectedness. For me, it's maybe that dual sense of feeling incredibly insignificant and yet incredibly precious at the same time. You look at the scale, and humanity is just this tiny speck on a tiny stack. But then you realize that, as far as we know, the life and consciousness happening right here is the most complex, maybe the most amazing thing in the entire known system. Dickinson's book really transforms the night sky. It stops being just a flat ceiling with twinkly lights and becomes this deep, three-dimensional neighborhood filled with bizarre, beautiful, dangerous, fascinating worlds. And it makes you want to keep exploring.
See you next time. with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.